Hey, it's Wendy. I am back today with another episode of Show Up or Shut Up. And I have one of our Fodder School 3 artists coming to you today. Her name is Yetunde Rodriguez. And it has taken me quite a while to edit this podcast episode. It's a long one. It was recorded in multiple parts. There may be some really jankety parts of this because I was having a lot of technical difficulties. It was actually this episode that I think put me over the edge finally and had me learning a different way of doing the recordings. And I bought a new microphone and I'm not doing my same recording method anymore. I'm actually using a different recording method. So it was very, very painful to edit this episode, and it is so far from perfect. It might be the worst sound quality of any podcast ever. But regardless, I know you guys appreciate these episodes. I know you guys appreciate what we put into them. And I'm excited to bring this one to you because I love Yetunde. She's a fascinating person. And we had a lot of fun recording this. Welcome to Show Up or Shut Up, a podcast about prolific makers, specifically in the world of mixed media art. I'm your host, Wendy Solganic, also known as Willa Wanders, and I'm here to explore the ups and sometimes the downs of being a prolific mixed media artist. I've been a maker my entire life, and I've had four separate careers involving art. In each episode, we'll talk to artists about how they became prolific makers, why they make art, and the struggles they go through. We'll talk about being an online creative, social media, and how to navigate that world if that's what you're into. Whether you're a casual art lover of mixed media art and collage, or a serious artist making a living with art, whether you're a handmade book artist, an art journaler, a 3D assemblage creator, a fiber artist, a collage artist, or everything all at once, I hope you'll join me on this journey into the world of mixed media making. If you like this podcast, hit the subscribe button and leave a review. You can find me, Wendy, at willowanders.com and on Instagram at willa.wanders. And at fodder.school. Welcome to the podcast, Yetunde.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. I've been an admirer of your work for many years now. I got up the courage to ask you to become a Fodder School 3 teacher, which probably sounds like I'm a nutbag. But when I admire, when I really admire someone's work, you can put people on a little bit of a pedestal. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe everyone does that a little bit, or at least I hope they do, because that's what I do. And I put you on this pedestal. And then I was like, always thinking, I wonder if she would ever be interested in teaching as a teacher in Fodder School, because I would love to learn from her. Mm-hmm. And you said yes.
Well, that is actually hilarious to hear myself being put on a pedestal, because I do that all the time. There's so many creatives and artists and creators that I look at and I'm like, wow. So to hear someone say that about me is just, wait, what? So yeah, thank you so much. I'm just here doing my own little thing. That's all I can
do. Well, I love what you're doing, and I'm really excited to hear about your story and who you are, where you come from, why your work resonates so much with people. So can we start at the beginning?
Absolutely. So the long version.
Tell me anything that people might be interested in, where you're from, how you ended up in the United States, where you're, because everything relates, I think, to your work. Right?
Yeah, everything ties in, absolutely, because you become who you are from the experiences you've had, so, and it all comes out in the work. But yeah, so I'm originally from Nigeria. I was born there, early 70s, so go Gen X. And so we moved to the U.S. when I was 13 years old. So my formative years pretty much were over there, and it was great. I loved it. I grew up watching all the women, really everyone in my family was creative in one way or another. It was just part of life. We didn't sit down and say, oh, we're going to just be creative. It was just part of the culture. It's probably not so much that way now because every culture evolves and changes. But that's how it was. All my aunts, all five of them, they sewed. Well, actually, I think there's five. I have five aunts, three uncles. And they all sewed and made things and cooked and all the stuff. My mom passed away when I was 9 years old, so we were still back in Nigeria. So I lived partly with my oldest aunt for about 3 years while my dad went off and tried to figure life out, I guess. So while we were there, we had a communal kind of home life. Like, because the culture there, it's not just father, mother, 2.5 kids. Yeah. It's a little bit of extensions. And so it's a lot of times, like if a family member is not as financially resourced as another family member, they might send their kids to go live with that family member, and they do housework in exchange for getting an education, because over there your primary and secondary education is not free, you have to pay. So even though that wasn't my exact circumstance, but there were other people in the household who were there for that. So I lived with my aunt, my uncle. There, by that point, their three kids were grown up in college or whatever. So we had another like cousin who we weren't really related to. It was like more like my uncle's niece. She lived there. They had another girl that was a little bit older. She lived there as well. And everybody had different chores. So maintaining the household was not solely based on the wife or the mother of the family. Everybody had a bit part. Like you had a chore you had to do every morning before school. So all those kind of things really informed, you know, how I viewed life. I thought it was idyllic because, again, you knew what your role was. It was like, okay, I'm responsible for this thing. Like the older girl, she was responsible for the cooking. We all washed our clothes on Saturday in the tub. We didn't have a washer and dryer. So I really grew up making and doing from scratch. So when we came to America with my dad and my new stepmom, I was like, oh, I was blown away by the abundance that I saw. Like, I remember first stepping into Kroger, the grocery store. Now, this was in Morgantown, West Virginia. That's where we landed. Well, my dad had always been coming back and forth to the U.S. since the 70s. So he was always getting some degree or another. So he was getting his PhD at West Virginia University. So that's where we ended up. So we landed here, and I was just like, wow. I was impressed by the lineup of produce, the little packs of meat. It was so unlike anything I'd grown up with. Like over there, grocery shopping meant you went to the market and you haggled with the meat seller and you haggled with the fabric seller, just all these different. It was just so completely different. So, but I was just blown away. But so on and on, I don't know if that gives you some sort of background of what I was working with in my youth.
It definitely does. I'm overcome with emotion. I think everyone knows that there was a time. Sorry.
Okay.
Everyone knows there was like a time in humanity where people lived like you're talking about. And it's like we have totally.
I'm like gonna sound like a yes. Crazy person.
No, not at all.
Connected from the source of our food, our loved ones. Mm-hmm. We just live in these big houses by ourselves with our nuclear family. Mm-hmm. We're not living with our aunts mm-hmm. and uncles. We're not living with our cousins. It's like a super. It's like we have the benefits of progress, right? There's certain benefits, mm-hmm. but the things that we mm-hmm. lost along the way are so sad. I just don't even know if it's sustainable for society, for humanity. This is, I'm for sure sounding like a crazy person.
No, you're not
when
at
I
all.
When I think about this, it makes me so unbelievably emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the way that you're describing growing up is exactly the way our parents grew up. Like, my mom grew up with her aunts and uncles, with her cousins, in one tiny apartment in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. That's how they lived. And when right, and like you talked about the whole financial, like, when one member of the family was failing because whatever, they lost a job, they lost a business, they couldn't keep up, then they were taken in by the other family, the aunt, right? The sister, the mother would take. It's just that's
they lived.
And when you talk about growing up and cooking and making, like, that is how I grew up, where there was always a sewing machine out. We were always making things. My mother and grandmother were always mending clothing, and that's how I learned to sew, and that's where I got my creative bug from. I just saw them making things. They were always cooking. You are expressing that need of human to make. And one of the things that I'm most attracted to about your work is that you make functional items as fine art for your walls. And I'm just on your website right now, and one of the things that I've been thinking that I really want to do is block printing, and specifically on dish towels. It's just like a thing, not a complicated thing, right? But there's some, I mean, I want to hear all about you, but and I'm going to shut up really soon. My first massive foray into being a professional artist was I was making wheel pottery. So I was making plates and mugs and bowls and all that stuff. And it was like, I was so happy because I was making something that was beautiful, that was elevating the everyday. And so take it from here, because that's who you are. That's a lot of what you're doing.
Yes. And it's so wild to hear you say all this, because it's almost like a parallel with my oldest child, who's also my daughter. She's also a fourth year in college. And it seemed like for a while, she didn't want to create with me, but she would observe me from afar. And now she's doing all the things. She sews, she can crochet, she can cook, even though she never wanted to be in the kitchen with me, but it's there. And each of my children is creative in one way or another, even though they're all vastly different. But yes, in regards to the everyday, I have a deep love for home, for having a home, being in my home, arranging my home, decorating my home. So that was my first foray into the creative side of my business, doing something creative. Well, okay, I was always making things. So my first iteration of making was making body products. So back in the late 90s, early aughts, my whole thing was making soaps, lotions, bath bombs, all those things, right? So I did that for a few years. And then I kind of grew bored with it, but I still do it for my family. Like, I make lotion for my family. In fact, my son comes home from college, his mom, I'm out of lotion. He takes two big tubs with him when he goes back to dorm. So I did that for a while, but I would still always make in one way or another. Then, like, the middle 2000s, early middle 2000s, I don't even know how I discovered her, but I discovered Lada John's daughter. I love her.
I bought a bag from her 25 years ago at the National Stationery Show.
So I actually got to meet her in New York in 2008, I think. It was at one of the big craft shows they used to do in New York, Renegade. Yeah, it was at Renegade. We just so happened to be in New York. My husband's from New York, and we would go visit family. So we just happened to be there, and I found out, oh, it's Renegade is happening right now. Oh, yes. Wow. So I took my daughter. She was like 7 or so at the time. And we went out there and I met her. We got to print a bag together. It was amazing. But anyway, I saw her work and I was just like, wow, this is amazing. What drew me to it was the simplicity.
Yes.
And it was just so very like low tech.
Yep.
To do it. And I have every book she's put out pretty much. So I discovered that and I was like, huh, this is something I could do. Because I had always been interested in fabric and surface patterns, but it didn't occur to me that this is someone's actual job. Like, to even though you see it all around you, but you don't think about how it got there. So I started to kind of explore how can I print fabric or create fabric, especially for the home. Like I said, I love home decor is my jam. Even though I didn't actually get trained, well, a little bit. I always said, oh, if it hadn't been graphic design, originally I wanted to be an interior designer, but I didn't have the background to understand how to do it. So even though, like I said, I came from a very maker-centric culture, they didn't look at it as, it wasn't monetized. It wasn't, the whole thought was, you're going to be a nurse or doctor or lawyer or engineer. That was, those were the only options. So I couldn't come and be like, I would be an interior designer. But I always practiced it. Even as a teenager in Morgantown, West Virginia, in our little trailer, I would always look at that one page out of 17 magazine that they dedicated to decorating. And I would tack it to my wall. One day I'm going to do this. So going back to the fabric printing of it all, I discovered that, oh, this career path is called surface pattern design or fabric design.
Yes.
So I started discovering all these different designers. But as much as I loved their work, it felt too clean, too perfect. And coming from an African art and design background, I love things to be a little bit more wonky, a little bit more, like you were saying, primitive, if that's not the word, I'm sorry.
Well, made by hand. Made by hand. You see the maker's hand in the object. Yeah.
So I was like, and two, I didn't see a lot of people that looked like me. Even now, I still don't as much. There are a few that I've discovered. But I was just like, okay, how can I get this look into the home? Because back then, African fabric and design wasn't as popular as it is now. It's gotten more popular since. But even then, it's not being done in the way that I would have wanted to do it. It's like people are afraid of color and they're afraid of imperfection. And they're afraid of anything that doesn't look like it's been lined up perfectly. So I started there. One of the very first things I printed was a sheet set for a friend of mine that was getting married. So I took the Ghanaian Adinkra symbols. Don't know if you've heard of them, but it's in Ghana, there's a culture called the Twi. And it's TW. I think that's the right one. There's a few different cultures, but they have this whole pictographic language that each symbol represents a certain concept. And to me, I was like, wow, what a phenomenon. It's something I had known about for a while and I had seen used in different things, but I said, what if I was able to interpolate those patterns into something else? So I took the Adinkra symbol for love and kind of made a design around it with the word love and created a screen, because I taught myself to screen print, because that was the first thing I learned was screen printing. But it was just so much, so cumbersome, and so it just was opposite of the way I like to work. So, but I did it and printed her a sheet set, gave it to her. And then I was like, huh, what else? So I started exploring. At first, I tried to design on computer, and it just, I wasn't getting what I wanted. Then I went back to school for interior design for a year in the local community college. And one of the classes we had to take, one of our very last projects was block printing. So, and I had done that in my first degree, but we just very lightly went over it. So this project, I enjoyed it so much. I carved this beautiful image, printed it, and that was it. And I was like, oh, this is really something I could do. It's simple. It's very low tech because, like I said, with screen printing, you can do all the steps right except for one, and the whole thing's ruined. You got to start over. But with block printing, it was so great. And I love that I didn't have to think too hard about how I was going to design it or anything. I could literally do anything and make it, and it would look good in the end. So I just took that and ran with it. So that's...
Yeah, I'm going to interrupt you because while you were telling this story, I started Googling and I found the Adinkra symbols. And I think that people who are listening should go right now and look at... They should visually reference what you're talking about. So it's spelled... Mm-hmm. The spelling is Adinkra. And yep. If you Google search Adinkra symbols, you're going to find a Wikipedia page all about them. And mm-hmm. I have never heard of this before. I have never seen this before. And mm-hmm. I think that the audience of people that listen mm-hmm. to this podcast is going to be so thrilled to see what this is. This mm-hmm. is what we do as mixed media artists. Right, mm-hmm. all of these marks, and mm-hmm. we make them repetitively. That's mm-hmm. a lot of what draws people in is repetitive making. Not all artists do things repetitively, but I find that the people that I work with really enjoy repetitive things. So whether it's just making a repetitive mark with a pen or a pencil, or mm-hmm. making a stamp and making a mark with that stamp repetitively, and that's mm-hmm. the genesis of what fodder creation is. That's where fodder yes. school comes out of. It's we're going to create these materials. In order mm-hmm. to create these materials, you're going to do a repetitive process. Then we're going to make something out of the materials. So when they see these Adinkra symbols and where the history of this is for humankind, mm-hmm. imagine that these symbols are at least 10,000 years old. I mean,
they're very old.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can see that, right? It's always amazing to me because when you're in something, you assume everybody knows about it.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, oh, but everybody's doing such and such. No, they're really not. Yeah. There's people who are in the art world who still have no idea about Adinkra symbols.
I had no idea.
Oh, and there's several different things like this, symbols like that, not just Adinkra. There's the Northern tribe in Nigeria. They have their own pictographic language. The Southeastern peoples of Nigeria, they have some too. The names are failing me right now.
So but, I've seen this before, Native American population.
Yes.
So when yeah. I traveled to Arizona, like you could buy books of symbology, which when I was making pottery, I was very intrigued. Mm-hmm. The symbols. And now I'm like, oh, I want to find, what did I do with those books? I want to find the books because you can really take a lot of inspiration. Maybe you don't take the symbol exactly the way mm-hmm. the people of Ghana made the symbol, but you can look at them and be inspired right. and say, oh, I want to make my own symbology.
Yep. And that's really where my work evolved to. People always ask me, these symbols that you make, what do they mean? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just something that came to me. Like whenever I get stuck for ideas, I'll go look at something. And I don't like to just take. That's why I started off with Adinkra symbols, but I very quickly moved on because I don't want to just copy that. To me, there's not really much creativity in just making the symbol that's already there. I find that I would much rather interpolate that symbol or make my own that mimics, or not mimics, that harkens back to that
Yeah, but, that's inspired by it.
Right, it's inspired by, but I don't want to just take it and make that. And I know there's probably absolutely nothing wrong with that, because I think at this point it's hard
to create new things.
Yeah,
especially with the connectivity of everyone, where it's like we have access to everything everywhere all at once.
All at once. Yep. Exactly.
Yeah. Like, and it's like you're trying to create something new or unique, but it's like how many? I love leaf imagery, and leaf imagery is everywhere. Yeah. And it's, can you create new leaf imagery? Does the fact that it's everywhere, does that mean I can't touch it? Mm-hmm. But I love it so much. I don't know.
It's a very complicated
question, or it's a very complicated thing that we're all grappling with, of how personality is required of a human.
Right. And that's something I grapple with a lot, because I so want to be original all the time. But also I have to remember that even when I think I'm being completely original, I may have come across something that I wasn't consciously thinking about at the time that I was creating what I was creating. But everything's out there. There's nothing new under the sun.
Right.
So I just do my best to interpret it my way. And that's really all I can do.
I guess then the answer is, does it feel original to you, knowing that probably somewhere at some time, and even maybe parallel to us creating it today, there's other people creating the same thing. So
yeah,
I don't even know. I mean, for me, to be honest, I feel that there is an artist personality and then there are all these other personalities. Mm-hmm. I feel that the people who most strongly identify as artists feel very connected to the idea that they need their work to be original.
Yes.
And for me, because I definitely am not an artist with a capital A, I'm more about, I just enjoy the process. I enjoy the repetitive mark making. So if my work is original or not, to me, is not the defining characteristic of whether or not it's what I want to do in my life, I guess. I just want to make repetitive things. I just want to make a lot of the same thing and go into that zone of feeling like I'm in flow. And even though, would I love to have a mark that was originally mine? Of course I would. I mean, who wouldn't want to have something original? But am I going to stop creating, wait for myself to have an original idea? I don't need to wait for that, because the urge to make is so strong.
It is so strong.
And like, so I don't wait for that, but it's a really big block for them, is that they have this fear that they shouldn't create unless they know they're creating something original. And I don't know the right answer. I don't know.
Let that go. Let it go. Just make, because you and I could draw a box and it would not be the same. So just bring yourself to it. That's the only thing I can say. Because I tend to suffer from some of that, wanting to be so original all the time. And it's like, the more you focus so hard on being original, the more you are doing something there's a group of people that would be considered original, but they all have the same kind of characteristics. So even within that, it's not. Let it go and just create because you want to create. That's what I have to say about that.
I'm so curious if I look at the Native American pictographs, whether or not there will be overlap with
Ghanaian
pictograph. Because talk about, there was no technology connection 10,000 years ago for human beings on different continents using the same marks, using the same symbols. I don't know the answer. I'm curious. Definite things I've observed is there's artifacts from 15,000 years ago, like human made, and there's marks on them. And the mark that we make today, the same repetitive marks are the marks. Mm-hmm. There's cave art, I think. Don't quote me, anyone. 3,000 years ago.
Wow.
And it's, I mean, human beings are making, we're all in this mixed media world making those same marks. That to me is amazing.
It is. And I have several books on like African art and all that. So always trying to, because people started to ask me about the symbols and all. So I was like, well, I guess I'd better know what I'm talking about. So in fact, one of the most ubiquitous design elements I've seen in art is like the chevron, right? So you take something like the chevron or the zigzags. That is in all cultures. They're just interpreted differently. And in African design, in the book I have at least, that design is called the broken calabash. So when you think of a calabash, a gourd, when it breaks, it's going to have the jagged peaks and valleys. And that's what they reference in that, with that zigzag kind of design. So
yeah, I'm looking up broken calabash right now because that's not a term that's familiar to me. Broken calabash images. All right, I see the broken gourds. So you're saying that the chevron design and the jagged edge have a relation to each other?
Yes. So I'm not going to say that they invented that, but when you look at it, if you broke a calabash or a gourd, it's going to have jagged edges. If you go to Google Images, if you just put in broken calabash, there's a Getty image of African calabash photos and primitive design or something. And you can see what I'm talking about. So even though their chevrons or broken calabash looks different from what you would see in modern home decor, the idea is still the same. The triangles, the peaks, valleys. So that's what they call that design.
Oh, that's a gorgeous design. Oh, I gotcha. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was what they were thinking when they painted that mud hut.
Oh, I totally see it now. Okay. I think if people look it up and they see, they're going to be like, oh yeah, I'm totally familiar with it. It's these V's. It's patterning with V's.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. And that just came from, oh, we have a bunch of gourds and, oh, look at the shape that came up when we broke it.
Yes.
You work with what's around you. And so I tend to use a lot of those V's, but I try to make it different every time. But there's only so many ways you can draw them to be different. And you just try to modify it with color and scale and all those design words.
I'm looking at image online. It says African calabash photos. And it's this gorgeous, what looks like a structure, like a home. And all on the exterior of the structure is calabash patterns. And what I'm thinking of is Zentangle.
Okay.
And how that Zentangling and how popular it is. And I'm like, and I know that maybe not so much for people in our generation, but definitely with my daughter's generation. Mm-hmm. My daughter, who's the maker, the one who does the crocheting and all that stuff, she's also a tattoo artist. So that's her side hustle. And she does a lot of tattoos. Mm-hmm. There's a really big awareness of not culturally appropriating other culture designs, let's just say. So have you thought a lot about, you know, because you come from a very distinct culture and you're clearly, your work is derivative of that culture and that's appropriate, right? And then other people who maybe want to take inspiration from your work could be culturally appropriating and not realizing it or not understanding the history of it. I don't know. Has any of this been something that's been in your life in the last 5 years, this whole discussion of this?
I guess the answer to that is it's complicated because there's appreciation, then there's appropriation. So to me, appreciation is, wow, I love this thing. I want to try my hand at it. And appropriation is, oh, this is really popular right now. Let me make some and sell it. So to me, part of it is your intent. I'm not somebody that's going to say, oh, well, you're doing this thing. I don't, in some ways, I can feel a little bit territorial about it, but also I try to remain open-minded that, okay, people love it. That's why they're trying to do it. Like, there's a maker that is someone I know. And when, what's the Dutch wax print fabrics? I don't know if you're familiar. It's like the very colorful African fabrics that everybody's wearing. A lot that, of people are wearing that.
There's clothing, like dresses and
everything
are made out of. Okay, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that got super popular over the last few years. And it was funny to me because this was stuff we grew up wearing. And fun fact, it's not even actually African. Africans wear it, but it's Dutch wax. It's like it came from the Dutch. They started that, but I guess they didn't wear it as fabric. They weren't into it like that. I don't know what they did with it, but that's synonymous with dressing African style. Okay. So that got really popular. And my friend that, like I said, I knew before the internet and everything, she has a home decor line and she started designing her own because it was so, I guess it was hard to consistently get the same print. So she designs her own, but not original. I don't know. I honestly don't know how she sources the images that she uses. But the thing is, she keeps it very quiet. Like, people don't know that she's making it. She's designed the fabric herself. So for her, it was a means to an end. I like this print. I'm going to design one that looks just like it and use it to make my pillows or whatever. And I don't know how to feel about that because I'm like, it feels a little dishonest, but also it's business. So that's a tricky one for me. But I do feel a little peeved when I'm in Target and I see their version of mud cloth.
So that's the example of cultural appropriation is when a mass manufacturer is taking a pattern from another culture because it's popular and trendy.
Right.
And okay, so that definitely is a nuance that I did not understand. So when someone in their home making mixed media art is inspired by a pattern from a native culture and they start drawing on a piece of paper, that's not what is known as cultural appropriation. Because they're not, it's the appropriation part, it's being inspired by looking at patterns and then having fun in your home would probably not be offensive.
Right. To me, what makes it offensive is, say, Target, they've got their own version of mudcloth. Because let's face it, these patterns are not, they're not complicated. They're not exclusive, I guess. You know, when you can make a pattern that looks like mud cloth and then have it printed and saturate the market with it. What offends me about it is that now people who don't know about the history and the background of it are going to think it's Target.
Yeah.
They're going to think Target came up with it.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's what offends me. And I feel a little twinge of, oh. But also, if Target approached me and wanted me to design something, I wouldn't say no, mind you.
Right, it's like with your name on it.
And... Right, with my name on it. Right. Yes.
Right. So definitely Target and all of the big box stores. I remember when we did the National Stationery Show, they would have looking around the show, looking at all the small independent designers.
Yep.
And looking at what was hot. And never paying those independent designers. They would just take whatever they wanted.
Right.
And they would just be like, oh, that person, I specifically remember a very cool idea. And then I saw it showing up. It's like, I saw it at the show and I was really impressed by this small independent art. And then I remember walking in Target and being like, oh my God, she got picked up by Target. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And then I went over and I looked at the cards and I was like, wait, where's the artist's name?
That's not her.
By Target. And I was like, Oh, that's what Target is doing at the shows. They're just going to find out what's hot.
Right. And in a way, well, I mean, that's a chance you take when you put your work out there. But also, gosh, why couldn't you just bring me on instead of having your designers just knock it off? So
it's a complicated world out there.
Yeah. And that's the thing that's the double-edged sword of your thing becoming popular in the world. Just right now in music, Afrobeat is huge. I don't know if Afrobeat is huge. And I remember going to New York about maybe 4 years ago and being really shocked to hear it in the street. I was just like, wait, what? Y'all know about Nigerian music? Even though some of that's been watered down to kind of fit American ears, I guess. But I was just like, what? And now there's all these collaborations like Ed Sheeran and Burna Boy making songs together. And it's wow, this is great. But at the same time, well, I guess it doesn't bother me as much because those artists retain, their name is still on it. But then there are other artists who I can tell want to make more traditional sounds, but they're not going to be as popular because it's not as tuned to American ears.
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
The question is, do people listening to Burna Boy know where that comes from?
Right.
And
do they understand what he's saying even?
Probably not.
Right.
Probably not. Right. I know my daughter listens to him. I know that name has come up many times in our house.
Yeah. Yeah. He's very popular.
Very popular. So, okay. It's a complicated world out there. Anyone who makes art is navigating these complex issues with each other, between each other. Social media makes it so that we're all connected in ways that create conflict and also create amazing inspiration.
Right. And
even like being a fodder school instructor is a unique experience in the sense that you're going to inspire thousands of people to create art like you. And then that art is more visible because it's not just you creating it. It's also thousands of people.
Right.
They're always crediting you, but it's just an interesting experience that everyone has to navigate.
Yeah.
But okay. So I want to go back though to your personal story.
Okay.
So how old were you when you moved from Nigeria to the United States?
I was 13.
Yeah. So, and you were telling the story of how shocking it was, the abundance and how different life was. So what happened for you at that point in your artistic story? Did you start going to public school? Were you able to create art there?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I love talking about this part. So, at the age of 13, we moved to the U.S. I went to high school in Morgantown, West Virginia. And so back then in the late 80s, they still had all the fun classes, woodshop, crafts, home economics. We had all those great classes. Now, it's so sad to me that those classes are gone for the most part. So one of my most favorite classes, it was just a 9-week session, a quarter, was crafts. So we made things in there, worked play, all that stuff. And then another 9 weeks was fashion design. And this was when Dirty Dancing came out. And so for our final, our fashion design teacher had us watch Dirty Dancing. And we had to note the different styles of fashion, like the dirndl skirt, the empire waist, the dolman sleeves. So we had to notice maybe 30 minutes into the movie, we forgot all about that and just were watching the movie. But it was a fun and creative way that she did that. In home ec class, we cooked. We had a fully functioning kitchen and we learned how to make whatever, different things. So I really always gravitated towards those classes because, again, I just was a creative kid. And I remember when we first moved here, I used to stash the styrofoam packs that they use for meat and stuff. Because I was like, I just know I can do something with this.
Yes.
I started collecting them. And pretty soon it became clear that I had to let them go because they would pile up so fast. And I still struggle with that, always wanting to reuse and recycle things. And now there's so much everywhere all the time that it feels silly to save those containers. And that what's funny is, so as part of my day job, I teach a DIY art class with seniors. I work at a rec center for the city. That's my day job. And so part of why they hired me was because of my art background. And so we have this Friday class with seniors. And so it's funny to see all the seniors. These are all people in their 70s and 80s. And they're just a fun, they're a riot. I enjoy them so much. But they save all the containers.
Yes.
And it's so funny to me because I'm like, yes, I know this life. I know this life. Yes, they save all those little applesauce cups and yep. all that stuff.
Plastic bags.
Yeah, they don't go out and just buy a pack of four containers. They're like, no, we're going to totally save the Subway box because we're going to use it to we're store gonna something. Use it again.
Yes.
Yeah. And I love that. That was in the late 2000s. That was my big thing. I just wanted to recycle everything. But then there were just obstacles in the way. And I miss when we had to be creative in with our materials. But now, whenever a craft gets popular, you can find the supplies in Joanne or wherever.
Oh, as opposed to having to source.
To figure it out, yeah.
This, which is yes. how we made when we were kids. It was like, right. what's falling off of other stuff? What's left over and how am I going to repurpose that and make a dollhouse out of those cardboard boxes and scraps exactly. of fabric? Right now it's right now go buy a kit wrapped in plastic and a cardboard box mm-hmm. containing everything is pretty low quality. What's the opposite of that? Fodder school is collect all your toilet paper rolls.
Right.
We're making those.
We are using them up. Because one of my fondest memories in Nigeria was, so like I said, I lived with my aunt and uncle, and they were like kind of big wigs in government and the community. So they were members of different organizations. And so they would host a lot of like cocktail parties and things like that. And we would cook. Because over there, you cook outside. That's a big part of it. Like, you have your indoor kitchen, but then you also cook over an open fire. And so us little kids would gather the scraps of the little discards of food that they were getting rid of when the adults were cooking. And we would take, say, the can of tomato sauce or whatever and use that as our pot. And we would make our own little fire. And cook our own little food as the adults were cooking the food for the party. So I just love that. So I'm like, oh, I miss that. And our kids just don't have that opportunity to do that.
That's why I was crying.
Yeah. Yeah. Even my kids, like, oh, I'm like, oh my gosh. Well, how am I going to get them to be able to do this, to have this kind of experience?
I think they have to feel that there's something missing. I know that my oldest daughter is in a process of figuring out who she wants to be and how she wants to live. And it's very different than mm-hmm. how I'm living right now. It's much mm-hmm. making everything yourself, mm-hmm. not feeling like you're driven by capitalism, living within a very low means and just being more connected, I guess, to materials. And I don't know, I'm so happy to see it. It makes me really happy that,
yeah,
that she's choosing a different way of life than I just followed what we're all trying to do the right thing, right? It's like mm-hmm. following mm-hmm. what we think we're supposed to be doing. That's how mm-hmm. I ended up in law school, the worst place for me. where I was just doing what I was a good girl, just doing what I was supposed to. Really, what I wanted to be doing was making dollhouses out of cardboard boxes. You know? Right. So eventually I kind of found my way back to it. But okay, so high school was pretty good because there was home economics and there was woodshop and all of that stuff. What did you end up doing after high school?
Like you, I was the good girl. I did what I was told. So after high school, well, by the end of high school, it was pretty clear that my aptitude for science wasn't that great. I revere science, but biology, who wants to learn that? So, but it was pretty clear that I wasn't going to become a doctor. So it was like the next best thing, be a nurse. So sorry, nurses, I don't mean to insult your career. It's a very wonderful field that the right people in it make all the difference. But so I went on to start studying nursing.
Wow.
But yeah, but I failed organic chemistry and that was the end of that.
Oh, that is such a hard class. That is crazy. Thing I did, my parents were like, do you want to be a doctor? And I was like, I can't do that. There's no way I was going to pass organic chemistry. I also didn't want blood and gore. So instead of becoming a nurse, the other option they gave me was you could be a lawyer. So I was like, I guess if I can't be a doctor, because becoming a doctor is like the epitome of success. So it's like, I can't do that. So I guess I'll do the other thing. I'll become a lawyer. And that was a horrible mistake. Okay. So you rejected becoming a nurse. And what did you decide to do?
Well, I decided to join the Navy.
Wow.
Radical pivot, right? Yeah. So when I didn't do so well in school, I knew that I was like, I have to figure something out. I didn't want to go back home and live under my parents and all that. So I joined the Navy and that's what I did for the next 5 years. Because at the time I still didn't know what else I wanted to do. So I went into a medical field in the Navy because that was always what I was prepped for. So I was a dental assistant in the Navy and I did that for 5 years and even considered going to dental school. And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. So I didn't do that. And so then I went on to study graphic design because, like I said, I had always been interested in design and art and all that. But by that point, I was my own person. So I got out of the Navy in 1996. So by then I'm 24 years old. So, you know, my parents didn't really have much, or my family didn't really have much to say about what to do with my life. So I was like, I'm going to study graphic design. So that's what I did. And that was really when I started to get into this whole creative field, even though graphic design itself, it can be creative depending on what you're doing.
Yeah.
But I've never had a job in that field.
But you have the training. Like, you started when the Adobe Creative Suite was just becoming.
Right. Back then, they didn't even have Creative Suite. We had Photoshop 4 or something. So I've been working with those programs since 96.
Wow.
So yeah, and because, you know, where I was, the school I went to, it was just a major. There was no guidance on helping you find a job or anything. So I got the degree, but didn't really get the experience. And so I was just always doing my own thing. I always wanted to live on my own terms and make money how I wanted. So I've been doing that since, but I do step into employment from time to time, depending on what I'm trying to accomplish. So from getting that graphic design degree, I discovered the soap making. I watched this one movie. Oh my God, still one of my favorites, Practical Magic. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Yeah, it came out in 98. It stars.
How to make soap. Hold on.
Oh.
How did you learn how to make soap? It's not easy.
I learned from books and the internet. Yeah.
Do you remember the name of the book that you learned from? There was a book.
Oh, yeah. I have all my books still. Let me dig them out.
One of the first books on soap making was written by my husband's sister.
Oh, really?
And oh, wow. My husband consulted on the book because my husband's a chemist.
Oh, wow. Small world.
Like the hand. What was the book? The hand. Oh, God, we have it here. Let me go see if I can find it.
I know. I'm digging mine up now because I'm in the process of moving. So I have boxes of books and yeah, I have
Handmade Soap Companion or something like that.
That's probably, yep. I'm pretty certain I have that one.
Because it was the first yeah. Public.
Yeah. By Susan Miller Kevich.
Yes. Susan Miller is Steve Miller's sister. And when she started making soap, she called my husband to explain the process.
Oh, wow. What a small universe. That is hilarious.
Okay. I just had to put it in there. Okay. So the movie, back to Practical Magic.
Uh-huh. In it. So the movie starred Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman. They were sisters and they were witches. And so Sandra Bullock's character had this shop that became internet lore. It was called, oh God, what was the name of the store? I can't remember, but it was named after Verbena. That's it. It was named Verbena. And it was just so beautiful. And I was just like, oh, I want to live this life.
Gotcha. So today, I do remember this movie now. I'm looking at it on Wikipedia. Okay. I don't know if I remember
that. I was like, oh my gosh, I love this. And just on, what was that show? God, with Schitt's Creek.
Yeah.
How is it David? He had that store. It was that same kind of look to it. And I was like, oh, I love it. But so anyway, I was like, I want to do that. So then I was in the bookstore and I started seeing these books about making your own soaps and lotions. And I still have the very first pair of books that I bought on the subject. I keep all my books and all my pages I printed from the internet. So I started doing that. So I learned just from books. Like you said, the Soap Maker's Companion is like the Bible. Soap making, because it really, I like to get into the nitty gritty of everything. If I'm doing something, I want to get granular and know exactly. I don't want to just buy the soap, melt it down, color it, and scent it, and call it
right. Not what not what you buy in the craft store.
No,
that's not soap making. Right, you want to mix the chemicals yourself and get the lye out.
Yep, like, exactly. I still have lye till today, sitting in here in case I get the urge to make some soap. So I got really into it, using the herbs and coloring with herbs and spices and all the stuff. And it did well for years, but I'm not the best business person. So I just do things because I love to do them. And then people are like, you should sell this. And so I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll do that. But but I found that I was so into the packaging. The aesthetic drew me more after a while. I loved designing my packaging and making it all pretty. And then I was like, so that dovetailed nicely when I started designing patterns and things like that. That was the next evolution for me. But the look was different from, of course, designing packaging. But I still love seeing a good package. Like when you see like really fancy chocolate and the packaging is just gorgeous. I'm just like, oh.
So the packaging design part of what you do now is what you're saying, which we're going to lead up to.
Well, not as much. Making
these homemade housewares. So are they, or basically people just buy the item without packaging?
Yeah, they just buy the item without packaging. I don't get to do as much packaging design, but that was what I was into it at the time, but it just led to this. But I don't really design packaging
like so when you do handmade kitchen towel, it doesn't have the belly band on it that's printed also with your
I do that, but one of the things about doing everything yourself is sometimes something's going to suffer because you're not going to be able to do every single thing. So I designed the packaging and people respond well to it, but I don't end up spending as much time on that part because by the time I design the fabric and all that, I'm all tuckered out. So I'm just making packaging that just says what you really
need
is.
You really need a production team.
Yes.
Where you design the prototype and then it's okay, now go make 100 of these or 1,000 of these or whatever.
Right. Right.
So just I'm just gonna jump ahead a little bit, but we're gonna go back because this is so fascinating. Have you ever been an Etsy seller? Because I could kind of see your stuff doing really well on Etsy.
Oh yeah, that's where I started.
Okay. All right. So go back. All right. So take us back again to this. So how do you end up becoming finished with soap? Because it sounds like you did it for many years.
Yes. That's part of the push was it was the time I had started having kids and I really wanted to be home with them. And so it was what I did to kind of bring income to the family. But as things change, I always get to a point where I become bored.
Yeah, I think everybody does.
Yeah, I became bored with soap making, especially because the market kind of got flooded with all these people who didn't really care about the nitty gritty like I did. They were just buying. There are all these companies that are private labeling. They sell you the base. And I always get to that point where it's a question of why am I still doing this? Should I be doing this or should I be private labeling? Even now with my art stuff, because I can't physically sew everything, there's companies that you submit your design, they'll print it and sew it for you. It may not have the soul that you put into what you hand make, but it gets the job done. So you have to decide whether you're happy with that or if you really want to keep chugging along the way that you were doing it. So with soap making, it came to a point where you are competing with people. You're going to the market and there'll be like 4 or 5 soap makers. And some of them really are making their soap from scratch. And some are just doing melt and pour. And
this is starting to all make sense to me. There was a massive proliferation of people selling handmade soap. So whereas it started and it was like incredibly special, when you saw someone at a craft fair selling handmade soap, it was like you were going to buy from that person because it was like that was the one person at the fair made that thing. And then 5 or 10 years later, there's a lot of people doing it, which is how everything works.
Everything works.
Everything is like this. Yeah.
And it goes back to what you were saying. If you're somebody who likes to be original.
Good. Yes.
So it's like you have to be able to understand. You have to be able to separate your passion for it from business aspect. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, when anything is a good idea, so I was an economics major in college, and amazingly, that has helped me so much in my life understanding, because economics is really like the study of human behavior as it relates to obviously and financial systems and all of that. But anytime there is a good idea, human beings are going to flock to it.
Right.
And if making soap is fun and there's profit involved, you have slowly over time or rather quickly flocking to that thing. And that's just how things work. So in a way, it's kind of like a good thing because it's, this is popular, but what I can sell this. There's a demand for it, a market for it. But if there is a demand and a market for it, you have to have the expectation. A lot of other human beings are going to pick up on that energy and they're going to want to be on that ride. I mean, just the same way that the business that I'm in now, which is online courses, which I love, not the person who created online art courses. I'm just riding an energy that I happen to be very enamored by and passionate about, but I didn't create that.
Right.
You know what I mean? I'm not the person who put up the first website with an online course. I just saw, and more, everyone wants to do that. And there will come a point where it is a mass saturation of that thing. And then everyone who does it is going to have to determine whether or not it's worth it to continue doing it.
Right.
Just like with the soap and, and even with all the things that we do, right? We always have to be evaluating whether or not it's still a good thing. So, okay, so
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so how did you transition? So you decided you wanted to be home with your kids. Was that kind of, I'm going to pack it up and I'm not going to make soap anymore?
Oh, no, it worked beautifully with me staying home because I did those.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, in fact, I remember doing a show when my middle son was just a month old. I strapped him to my back and was out there. So that was something that worked very well. But I started to kind of get bored and wanting out around 2006 timeframe. And that was the year I had my third child, but it didn't really have to do with that. But that's just how I time it in my head. But the break came around 2007 and it worked nicely because we relocated to Ohio. So up until that point, I was living in Norfolk, Virginia. And so in summer of 2007, we moved to Dayton, Ohio. And so that was kind of like a natural break point to kind of back off of it a little bit, even though after we settled in and everything, I didn't know anything else at that point, so I kind of tried to resurrect it. I started making liquid soap from scratch instead of just buying the base and all that. And I would still sell at markets, but it just felt like the thrill was gone at that point. So just kind of
the thrill. That's definitely part of what keeps you every day waking up and going back in, right? It's really appealing. And the thrill goes. and it's like, okay, that's it. The thrill started to leave.
So yeah, it just kind of started to dissolve. And for me, whenever I start to feel that way, I start to try to find new ways to make it fun and exciting again, or find new ways to make it work. But at that point, it's very easy to kind of go off the path of what you were doing. And so now I've learned that when I get to that point, I just need to stop, just drop it for a while, because you can very easily ruin it by saying, okay, well, I see this person is doing this. Maybe I should try that. I see that this is how things are being done now. Oh, let me do that. But I've learned now to just stop and get really quiet and just wait for the answer to come from within, I guess. And I recently had to do that even in my art practice, because around, I want to say this time 2 years ago, I started to sell wholesale on Faire.
Okay. And how do you spell Faire? F-A-I-R-E?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So it seemed like it was doing really well. I was getting orders left and right. I took on a studio space and I was looking to see how I could get other people to help me with it. But it didn't work out. And I stopped. I pulled my products because I was sewing plant pots round the clock.
So wonderful. If you guys do not know Yutunde's plant pots, go look at her Instagram account. Tell people, we never mentioned this in the beginning, because I like to say, tell me your Instagram right now so that people can look at your work. So while they're listening to the podcast, exactly. So I will do a little introduction here where I tell people how to find you right in the beginning. But tell us right now, what is your Instagram account?
Yes, my Instagram is at Yetunde, and I'll spell that. It's the phonetic spelling of my first name. It's Yaytonday. And once people see it spelled like that, they get it. They never mess up my first name again. It's yay, cartoon today.
Yes.
So that's my Instagram.
Okay, that's your Instagram. Mm-hmm. You don't spell your name like that. Your name is Yetunde, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So now that hopefully people have gone to Instagram and seen mm-hmm. your Instagram account and your work, let's mm-hmm. talk about the plant pots and all the other the amazing plant products pot you were hand creating. So you were creating the fabric and then and sewing it and packing it and shipping it and all of those things.
Oh my God, so much. I'm like, how did I do that? But yeah, so the plant pot covers came about quite accidentally. I was getting ready for a show and I always feel like I don't have enough product because up until that point, I was making those makeup pouches or the zipper pouches. Those, that was always my go-to, and pillows. I would make pillows, pouches, tote bags, all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I was getting ready for this show and I was like, oh my God, I don't have enough product, but I have all these small pieces of printed fabric. I can turn them into something. So I made a little pouch that didn't have a zipper and I stuck my plant in it. And I was like, huh, this is cute. So I was like, oh, I can whip these up real quick. So I made a bunch and went and did the show and I sold every single one. Because I took my plant with me. I stuck it in there so people knew exactly what it was. And people just really love those plant pot covers. I was just so amazed. It's never the thing that you think is going to hit. It's always something else. So it was just something silly I made and people just really loved it. But in true Yetunde fashion, I overthought and I would always modify the pattern and say, okay, it needs to have this. Or someone mentioned, oh, it should be waterproof. So now I'm on a hunt for how to make it waterproof. But when really, you just do what you do. And they can figure out how to modify it themselves. But after a while, like I said, I was making those almost round the clock. And I was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do production. I just want to...
Right, because being a production person is very different than being a designer.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure if the stores were selling them as well, but I just kind of backed off of it. But they're going to come back. They're going to come back. I'm just waiting for the right time.
Gotcha.
Because people still really love them. People always ask me about that. So this was just
2 years ago that you mm-hmm. started renting a space external to your home, which we haven't talked about that yet. That's like a very big part of someone's story, I think, is... You're working outside of your home. You're taking a big risk. You're making a commitment.
Yes.
Saying,
huge.
I'm going to do this full time. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that process of your thoughts and where you found a space and what the space was like. And that's a big deal.
Yeah. So it was becoming clear that, oh my gosh, my little home studio space, too tight, too small. It wasn't the right configuration. Plus, I have an artist son, so his stuff was in there too. It was just too much. So I was like, I need a studio space. I'm going to find a studio space. So for about 6 months, I was looking to see where I could get a space. I didn't know anything about commercial real estate or anything. And I would literally drive around because I wanted something that was close to my house. So I would drive around, look at for rent signs and be calling and nobody would ever get back to me. It's like they don't tend to take you seriously. But in my city, we have our downtown organization. They have a service where if you're looking for commercial space, they will connect you with the people that are renting that have the space. So I filled out their form, I went through the process, and sure enough, I was able to locate a space downtown. And it was beautiful, but it was in an office building. Now, also in my town, we have a thriving arts district, but the place where everybody goes to get studio space, they're always backed up. They always have a waiting list. Plus, I didn't really like it. It's very old, industrial, rickety, kind of. I wasn't really sure that was going to be right for me. So when I found this space downtown, and even though it was more than what I had wanted, it was as far as cost. I really just wanted 200 to 300 square feet, but I let myself be talked into 500 something square feet. But I was like, I could swing it. And I did for a while. But then I was like, hey, there's something that happens when you move out of your home studio, where it's not as, your creating is no longer now as intuitive. Because in my home studio, if I get an idea at 2 a.m. and I want to go try it out right now, I can do that. But right. Now there's a barrier between idea and execution, because I totally moved everything out to this space. And it was beautiful. I was doing workshops, in-person workshops, all this stuff. I had all these big ideas, but I forgot that I'm just one person. So far, I had a summer intern once, a high school student, but I didn't know how to bring other people on. No, I guess my problem.
There's a huge learning curve to, because mm-hmm. I don't know if I ever told you this, but I had a business for 15 years where we were mass producing custom handmade invitations. So it was a printing company and a design company. And we had at the height, we had 30 people working mm-hmm. in the company. It would be the kind of thing where if you were like, I want to make these housewares and distribute them to hundreds of retailers in North America, and you needed to build a production team, you would mm-hmm. even have probably designers working underneath you and a whole staff and a shipping department and a gigantic warehouse and all mm-hmm. of those things. So I did that once. I did that for 15 years. And mm-hmm. I know what it takes and what kind of things you have to learn along the way. And bringing on your first employee and mm-hmm. learning how to manage people, you got to have the right personality right. type. Probably yes. not the artist type. Like the right. true artists are the people who want to be the designers. The right. people owning businesses, those are the people who are better at managing people.
Yeah. And I learned that over the last couple of years.
Yes.
That was the big lesson, because when I started with soaps and everything, it was easy to say, there was this whole ethos of doing it yourself and bootstrapping and being out there with your product. But as I grew in kind of popularity, I guess, I started to feel like I shouldn't be the one out here at the markets. I shouldn't be the one doing everything. And I had to really think about whether that's a path I wanted to go down, being a boss, I guess.
Once you take on yes. that person, then suddenly yes. it's, I need to be worried about where the income is coming from, because right. now these other people are relying on me to bring mm-hmm. the income in. Worry about that while I worry about what they're doing every day and managing them. It's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot. And I was just like, ooh, is this really me? I don't know if this is me. So I just kind of, like I said, I just had to kind of put everything down. So I moved out of the space at the end of March. Thankfully, the new owners of the building cooperated with me and let me out of my lease, because I was just like,
unbelievably lucky. Most people will yes. not let you out of a lease. So
thank you to those people. I was okay. very lucky, because I emailed them when I started to feel like, this is not going to work. We talked through it, and I was like, look, I'm trying to settle this as amicably as possible. And to their credit, they were very kind. They really worked with me in letting me out. But I also suspect they might have had plans for the space, because when I first moved in, when I first signed the lease, it was owned by somebody else. And the owner was an architectural firm that was also, they also had their business in the building, and they kind of ran everything. And then they sold the building to some out of town person. And when they said they were selling the building, I started to wonder what their plans were for it. So I suspect that they might have had plans for it anyway. So, but I don't know.
Oh, okay. It might have benefited them Right. And that's why, because most people won't do that because they're like, right. yeah, you owe me money and I have a mm-hmm. legal contract. I'm not going to. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you got very lucky there.
Yes.
What are you doing now? You said your day job is working at the local art center with the retirees.
No, I work at a rec center, but okay. that's just one part of my job, just one day a week. So,
oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So that's not really the bulk of my job. I would love that to be what I do all the time because they're a hoot, but it's just one day I do that. But the rest of the week, I just work there. It's a rec center. They have workout equipment. People come, work out, swim, whatever. So it was just something to do for income. But I enjoy it.
So yeah. Are you still in your spare time drawn to printing fabrics, making things out of the printed fabrics? Or do you feel like you're at a point where you're like, I need to let that rest?
It's a little bit of both. Because I went through so many changes of I'm going to hand make everything to no, I'm going to outsource everything. So I'm at a point where I'm in between, I guess. I still love to print fabric. I love to turn it into something. I think my work has a different look when it's three-dimensional yeah. than when it's just flat. So that's why I love making pillows so much, because it just looks different, you know, to me than just a flat piece. But also I started kind of getting recognized as an artist. I've done a lot of collaborations locally. So I haven't sewn anything in a while, but it's not because I don't want to. Like I said, like I mentioned, I'm in the middle of moving right now. So that's going to all have to wait. But even through all the upheaval of moving, making and creating and doing art has been like a respite for me. Just like I always feel I can tell when I haven't been creating, when I start to feel out of sorts. And my husband's, have you made anything lately? That's probably why. So that's been a joyful piece of time for me in the whole process of getting ready to move out of our current house to our new house. So I do still enjoy creating. I'm always doing something creative. Even at work, in downtime, I'll bring, I don't know, a coloring book or a piece of air dry clay or something. So I'm always constantly creating. My coworkers know, oh yeah, she's doodling again. Yes. Even though that cracks me up to be called a fine artist.
I'm noticing mm-hmm. on your website that you have fine art for sale.
Yes. I started to realize that the art is really what's drawing me and what's drawing people. So even with that, I floundered a little bit trying to transition from creating patterns to creating art with a capital A, you know?
Yeah.
And even though my art friends/mentors have told me, just do what you do. For a while, I felt like, no, I can't just print fabric and hang that up and call it art. But I'm starting to realize, yes, you really just can. Yeah. Because I've seen, like, there's a local artist who is really hot right now, exhibiting all over the place. And she just sews triangles of different color fabrics together and stretches it. And that's what she does, you know. But for me, I'm like, I have to give more details, you know. And it's like, and my friend told me, he was like, just do what you do.
Wow. Are you going to have space in your new place or yeah. art studio?
Yes, that's exactly where I am right now. Okay. I was like, okay, first things first, I got to get my studio set up so I can keep working, you know, doing my videos for the Fodder School and all that. So yeah, I've got most of my supplies in already. There's just a few things still left to move over. So I was like, okay, gotta get that knocked out.
Do you have nice light in the new space?
Oh yes. There's two big window areas in four of the walls. And then like one of the other walls opens to the dining room, and there's a window, like a bay window, in the living room, which is next to the dining room. So it's really cloudy today, and I don't have any lights on, and it's still really bright.
So, cloudy yeah. days are the best filming days.
Yeah, I found that out. It gives really good light. Yeah.
So that's very exciting. So when we left off, we were talking kind of about the future for you, where you see yourself headed. And also I felt like there was kind of an undertone of change and rolling with it, and just kind of, you know, everything has a season, right? Like it's the truth. Yeah. And so you had the season of making the housewares. Or do you think you'll still be doing that? Or do you think you're really going to transition into other things?
That's the million-dollar question. So I've put down making the housewares for a while, but I keep getting pulled back in. So I think I probably will always have that component, but I'll do it differently instead of trying to hand make everything, as much as I love that. I think either I will not hand make everything, or just make just small batch instead of trying to sell on a mass scale, like wholesale, handmade, because production is just not for me. So I realized that, I've known that. So I think if I am going to do some handmade housewares, it'll either be just one product, or if I want a broader selection, then I will outsource making that and just have it to where, you know, people can order it and it just gets sent out, you know.
So basically you would be the designer, and yes. then there's places that could do the production and the shipping.
Yes. Yep.
Wow. Of basically, so it's having someone else make a handmade good, only you're outsourcing all that part of it to another company, and you get to be the designer, but you don't have to worry about production, managing people, managing inventory of materials. Like they do all of that.
Yep. They do all that. Except, you know, and you know, you made me think of something just now when you said I designed the handmade product, because my view was always, oh, it's not handmade if the computer is printing it. And I guess that's true, but it's still being sewn, you know, it's still being hand sewn, not, well, machine sewn, but it's still being produced at my request. So that still makes it handmade, I guess. It's just the printing part is not going to be hand printed.
I totally get it now. Okay. Yeah. So that is so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Like the level at which you need to be a purist in order to feel like you're doing the product the justice that it deserves.
Right.
Everyone has to make some compromise in life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably just a matter of the pros and the cons. If the reality is that if you don't have someone else doing the printing and the production, that the product will never make it into people's hands, that maybe it's worth it to say, well, I've tried doing this myself. It's not going to be sustainable, right? It's just not.
Right. It's not. And it's, also because I've not been able to make it consistent, you know, as far as sizing, styles. I'm always like, ooh, I like this style better, you know, and that's not good for business, of course, you know. So just having a company that says, this is what we do. Just give us your surface patterns and we will make it into this item and ship it out for you. That is great. And you can have a consistent product every time. You know,
and then, but it's up to you to market it. They don't do the marketing.
They don't do the marketing. So there's that also. So yes, you have to market it. You have to, you know, do all the other parts that, you know, makes people want to get it. So
okay. And then as far as the fine art, we were also talking about, which got me really excited and actually inspired something in me, is you were talking about how you saw that there was an artist in your area who was sewing triangles and you know, wrapping that on a, you know, on wood, whatever you call that, the frame.
Right.
And that, I mean, it must be beautiful.
Yes, it is. And not to even, I don't mean to diminish her work or anything like that, because I'm sure that if I were to say, let me see, because you look at it and you're like, oh, I can do that. But then when you go to try to do it, you realize, no, it's not that simple.
Exactly.
You know, so yes, I'm, you know, not to diminish her work at all. I just said that to say that I always looked at what I was doing as, oh, well, you know, I'm just printing and repeat. What's the big deal? But people are like, no, that's really what we want that. You know, that's.
We want that as our art on our
right,
wall.
Right.
Yeah. So the thing is, I really, really, really love decorative arts. More than I even really love looking at fine art. I've always known this about myself that I really love surface pattern design. And had I been born 20 years later, I probably would have been a surface pattern designer. When I was in art school, I was criticized for the type of art that I was making. Wow. And that made me realize that what I really just loved was decorative art and surface pattern design. But I was too timid and afraid, which was dumb, to go get my degree in graphic arts. Like, I should have just gone right then. I actually had looked into the program of getting a degree in graphic design, and I was a wimp. And but anyway, my point is that there are so many different types of people who like to look at different types of things. And I would imagine that a very interesting pattern that you develop would be very, very interesting to look at on a wall as a piece of fine art. And I was so inspired by our conversation that I actually was like, you know what? I've had this idea in my head. To me, it seems maybe too simplistic, but it's what I really love. It's what I really love looking at. And I want to turn this into a piece of quote unquote fine art, something that's frameable. And I did it over the weekend, and then I proceeded to make two more, and I'm making another one. And I'm like, you know what? If this is like what floats my boat, if this is what I like to produce, but I'm feeling like it's not elevated enough, it's not, because, you know, there's that voice in my head that's like, it's not fine art if it doesn't have like drama built into it. Like, you
know, I know,
like a whole, like, you know, the pain, the angst, the anguish of the artist. Like, if it doesn't have all that in it, you know, then it's not elevated enough. But I was thinking after our conversation, if it's what I want to look at on my wall, I trust that I really like this thing. And so I think I'm going to bring some of them and have them professionally framed, because they're in odd sizes, and I'll just see where it takes me. It's kind of worth it to follow that, and then put it online, see if anyone's interested in buying any of the pieces, maybe show my friends. I mean, I've always been very timid about this, but I'm finally making something that I actually feel like, wow, this is really me. Like, this is what I love, this is my aesthetic, and I could put my name on this and maybe want to make a lot of them and sell them.
So absolutely.
I want to be 100% behind you.
Thank you.
I would want that type of art. So why wouldn't other people want the type of art that?
Yeah. Cause if you like it, somebody else does too.
Yeah.
You know, and I've already sold pieces, so I know that to be true. Like, you know, I've actually sold pieces that I just was like, oh, I was just, you know, like I had an exhibition at a small gallery a couple of months ago, and I had a bunch of fabric that I printed from over the years. And I stretched them on a frame. I put them up and people bought them. You know,
I believe it.
So, yeah, I mean, I've worked with local arts organizations. They've commissioned me to print something up and donate to their donors, or not donate, but give to their donors as thank yous. Same gallery or same organization, they have an annual art auction. One of my pieces was in their live auction and it sold for a very nice price. So, you know, it's true. It, you know, I've got proof of concept. So
yeah,
just keep going with that. And I've got a couple of exhibitions coming up in July, August timeframe. So yeah, people want to see this.
I think that's so awesome and such a beautiful ending to this podcast episode is yes. Follow Yetunde and see where it takes her as she follows her heart and does what she wants to do. And I'm all in on you, Yetunde. I think you're...
Thank you.
Your aesthetic is awesome.
Thank you so much. It's always so gratifying for people, for me to hear that people enjoy what I do. And I'm just like, wow, really? Thanks.
Yes, really. All right. It's been a pleasure having you on. And I'm sure we will talk again real soon.
We will. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been fantastic.
You're welcome. And good luck with your move. And I hope your studio is beautiful. I can't wait to see it.
Oh, I can't wait to show it.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Show Up or Shut Up podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast and leave a rating and review. And once again, you can find me, Wendy, free gifts for newsletter subscribers, online classes with me and many other incredible instructors, my blog, and everything else at willowwanders.com and on Instagram at willa.wanders. Talk to you soon. Until then, stay curious and keep making.